Just tell me about Texaco in California, the oil side, as to when they were, when they came to California, how big that operation was.
Oh, okay. Texaco, I guess this was in the late 20s, decided they wanted to be market product in all 48 states. I think they were the first company that did this. And to get a handle out of the West Coast, they purchased an oil company that was operating up in the oil fields in Fillmore.
Where was that?
Fillmore is about halfway between Ventura and San Fernando or Pasadena. It's up in the first row of mountains north of the San Fernando Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of oil up in that area that was developed. And I don't know the name of the company. There were people working for us that came from that company when I first went to Mexico. And then they started there, but then they purchased an existing refinery that was down there in Wilmington, south of by San Pedro. But it's where all the refineries are now, and they built a little refinery down there. And the I don't know where our production came from. We had a lot of production up in the Ventura area. You down the highway 1, Santa Barbara to Ventura?
No.
Because now there's a lot of offshore, but there was a lot of onshore production in the early days. And that was all refined down in Los Angeles, along with the stuff from Fillmore. And we had some operations up in the San Joaquin Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it was shipped, well, I guess by pipeline, eventually down into the refining areas. And then Texaco became active in the exploration. We had found other fields, not the least of which was the one up in San Ardo, which we would have gone by down Highway 101 to LA.
Mm-hmm.
That was discovered in about 51, I think. So we maintained production, and then we got a lot of production when we went offshore down in San Pedro there's a platform out there that reaches the Wilmington field.
Mm-hmm.
But you still reaching the bay. And that caused the subsidence of the whole area that we had to put water back down and raise it back up again. Anyway, so we had quite a bit of production in California. We established a good market here. And then, of course, as we ran out of oil here, we began importing oil. And one of the major sources was Indonesia, which was right after World War II. They found quite a bit of oil down there. And there was a joint operation with Texaco and Chevron called Caltex. And in Texaco, tried to find oil in Alaska, but had a bunch of black holes. Anyway, we get food from Alaska now, I guess, as well as from Arabia. It's a long ways from here. To get here from Arabia, you don't have to go through the Suez Canal all the way around South Africa.
I'm just thinking that central gravity of production is in Texas. Center of gravity of research is in New York.
Yep. And Mr. Eastman is in California. I say he was a highly respected man in this company. The lab would never be there if it wasn't for that individual, I'm sure. And the things that we had done have been so successful were all envisioned by him. He was the whole concept of the way the gasification work went from he was the one that said, why don't we start making ammonia with our gasification technology instead of just trying to make synthetic crude? Because, what happened? I was assigned to the shale oil, and I worked diligently on that for several years. And,
what did you do? That's a pretty big, big assignment for one person, isn't it?
There was two ways to go. You either mine it and process it above ground, or you try to do it in situ. And there's still I worked on where we're going to mine it. And I visited the Bureau of Mines up there and went through all the mines. And they did a good job. We had large holdings of oil shale. They had bought back in the 20s. I guess they still do. Good idea, I don't know. But anyway, we discovered oil shale is. You define the quality of the shale by how many gallons of oil you can get out of a ton of shale. Mm-hmm. And anything more than 20 gallons per ton is considered pretty good shale. And they know as a Fisher acid, that you just heat this shale in a retort. How much you can get out of it under specified conditions. Anyway, we came out to Montebello, and we got shipments of shale out there, and we were working with it, and I had the idea that we ought to retort this shale with hydrogen. We had these pilot turbines there to make hydrogen seal and a shift converter. We could shift this thing and make 95% hydrogen out of it. After we scrub the CO2 out of it. And we tried, on a pipe like that, 6 inches in diameter, turning it through a channel. We'd run through a hammer mill and pumping hot hydrogen to it. We found that we could get 30 gallons of oil per ton out of this shale instead of 20. It was a huge number. Nobody realized it really that was possible. And we got some patents on this idea. And this was pretty hot stuff. And that's the company thought this was going to really be a winner.
Called it hydrotorting. Mm-hmm.
Hydrotorting.
This was when?
This was probably in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd gotten so involved in this was the main reason I didn't go back to Caltech. Because we were doing this and we were going to open a. We bought land up in Salt Lake City, we're going to open a shale or a laboratory.
This is all on the hypothesis of oil running out. I mean, it's not.
Well, yeah, I mean,
it's not energy crisis
well,
time.
No. I mean, it was forecast that this could be a viable source. We had not realized how much oil there was in the Middle East. Everybody knew there was oil there, but nobody realized it was quite as extensive as it was, as it turned out. But this was still I think we bought this land up there in 57, 58. And we were making serious evaluations of a much larger scale plant that we would locate up in the shale oil country. But every time we would make an improvement and get the cost of losing oil down, oil prices would drop. They weren't rising in those days. And then the problem of what we're going to do with all the tailings in this operation was always a problem. Well, we'll just put it back on the mine. We'll just dump it in the Colorado River and flow on out down the Hoover Dam. Anyway, it became more obvious that that's a major problem. And so the cost of the plant kept rising. We had to abandon any active research on that. In the meantime, because we had hydrogen available in quantities that were large enough to do some pilot plant studies on, we were asked to do studies and provide a process design for the first hydrotreating system, building refineries to treat middle distillates and gasoline to reduce the sulfur content of hydrogen and recover the H2S. The first one we built was a hydrotreater down at the refinery in Los Angeles, because you had to treat the naphtha to get the sulfur down before you could feed it to the platform and catalyst.
Was this a concern with catalyst poisoning or?
Yeah, it would poison the platinum catalyst. Yeah. So that if you could get this sulfur out ahead of time, you were better off. And we even did it. We moved up into diesel, little distillate, fuels and kerosenes. And we were doing a lot of work on that phase of it. And our laboratory was looked at, as a place where you get the process design to build a full-scale unit. So we were much sought after, and I was in charge of that part of the program.
which did actually, that went into production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those plants were built. I don't know, most of them are still operating. It may have changed to include catalysts by now. It was the cobalt moly catalysts that were insensitive to sulfur. But we had hydrogen-free sulfur we could use to run the plant.
And this is in the 60s?
Well, this is in beginning in the late 50s and continuing into the earlier 60s. But we didn't give up, you see, on our hydrotreating process. We said, well, if we can make oil out of oil shale or out of shale oil, what will happen if we feed residual oil into this thing instead of shale oil. And so we use this counterflow scheme of hydrogen going up and residual oil coming down. We had it coming down through gravel at first. In fact, we had it coming down through eventually a bunch of plates that just, you know, kind of go down and disturb its free fall as the hydrogen goes up through it. And we found we could take residual crude steel bottoms, which are normally for going to fuel oil in those days, and we could run it through this, so we could get 50% more gasoline out of it instead of something that was fuel. We called this tex fine. And we built that tech first. We had a large scale tech spiner there. We could run 100 barrels a day at Mount Bell. And we designed up to a full scale 5,000 barrel a day plant that we built. I think it was 5,000. Built down at the refinery in Los Angeles, a tech spiner, which was in the late 60s. And we needed hydrogen for that. So they used our technology to build the hydrogen plant, too, that we developed. And in the meantime, well, the text finding, by now I was supervising the whole research group. And we had refined our technology for making hydrogen, so we could use residual crude, or we could use fuel oil, or we could use any kind of liquid hydrocarbon. We converted to high purity hydrogen to be used not only for these hydrocreating processes, but for this text finding operation. So the text finding operation was a pretty high consumer of hydrogen. We consumed 2,000 cubic feet of hydrogen per barrel. Because after the gas came out that we'd made all the lower boiling hydrocarbons from this residual fuel, we ran it down from a catalyst rate without cooling. And that kind of removed the solvent and hydrogenated the opened and made a much better product. That was what was called text finding. Well, that was the only commercial plant that was built for text finding. And we were competing at that time with some of the fixed bed processes the Union had developed and Chevron had developed, using much more expensive catalyst but getting much more efficient conversion. They did have to use heavy gas oils rather than residual fuel liquid. Anyway, they fixed the technology. Union, I guess, had the best, I think. Exxon, they had too much. Exxon worked on the alkylation process. We never came up with a very good one on that. But this is back when we were still developing new processes for refining. But by now, our gasification technology was well along. And we had plants running like the Brownsville plant did, on natural gas and oxygen, making ammonia. all throughout the United States. We had it up in Canada. We had it, I guess we had one in Holland after we found gas in the North Sea. But places that didn't have natural gas, we were working to get them so they could run on residual oil.
And this is this technology that was developed in Monticello.
Yep, that's all around it, all about that now. Mm-hmm.
I want to go back in time and then come forward to this. And I go back in time and say, you go from Caltech to this different world. I mean, how different was it? I mean,
well, it wasn't as different as I expected, because we were encouraged to come up with novel things, and we were successful. And this business of building a plant in Timbuktu and starting it up and successfully operating. By the time I left, we had 60 commercial plants. By the time I retired, or some had been retired before I retired, and we had built some 60 plants. Well, we hadn't built them, but we had provided the technology for them. That's what supported the laboratory. And as long as back in that time, in the 50s and the 60s, as long as the licensing arm of the company, which was known as Texaco Development Corporation, was bringing in more money licensing the technology than it took to run the laboratory, and Texaco was making a net profit, they didn't care what we did.
And you were licensing it to other oil companies?
Well, we were licensing chemical companies.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And once we got it going on oil, we licensed it several plants in Japan. We began licensing the first one in Europe was in France. And then we raised the pressure that we could operate 1,500 pounds in the atmosphere. Well, I think 1,200 was as high as we ever built a plant, but we built a 1,200 pound plant in BASF in Ludwigshafen. And that was a real fun working with the Germans. The way they look at things and the way we look at things. We spent a lot of time over there. I spent a lot of time in that plant. And this was to make ammonia.
Mm-hmm. From
heavy fuel oil.
Mm-hmm.
Residual fuel oil.
When was that now?
That plant was started up originally in 1964.
How early is that?
Well, it wasn't started up, and that's when we started the design. They came over and renamed the test plant. That plant wasn't when it was on stream about 68.
What does this mean? Back in Monticello, was the staff growing? Was the population growing?
No, we didn't really grow very much. The company kind of took the attitude that they didn't want to spend a whole lot of money on stuff that they were just going to license. They could make more money finding oil and selling oil. And they were probably right. So in the meantime, they didn't. As long as we didn't ask for ridiculous amounts of money, and as long as we kept supporting ourselves, they kept us alive. And we had the backing of the Texas Development Corporation, and they were in the Chrysler Building. Key representation on the necessary financial committees and everything else. So we survived as an independent entity. It's almost like a startup company. But we did, when we moved to our proposal, moved the 1,200 pound operation to 1,500, we actually built a plan and went up to 2,400 pounds operating, so we could operate in some between. One of the strange things that you find as this pressure goes up, another component suddenly starts to appear as formic acid. And it was a long time before we recognized that that's what was our culprit. We had a lot of corrosion problems and we got the pressure way up. But as long as we were successful, and we were doing very well. Then by the time we looked like the oil was going in good shape, we tackled coal. We had tackled coal, Montebello had tackled coal before I ever came to Montebello. And the concept was they could take a slurry of coal and water and pump it through a heater and vaporize all the water, and then feed this coal steam mixture in with oxygen and make hydrogen CO. That part worked pretty well. We never could keep the heater from following up. The heat vaporizer was leaching too much stuff out of the coal out of the deposits in there. We had keeping high velocity, and that just never really worked too well.
What date did you begin?
I wasn't there then. This was
the earlier stuff. Still,
this was back before I went. I was there, and they had built a plant in what the Bureau of Mines is now in West Virginia. Morgantown. They had built a pilot there, and they built it in part. They built the plant, but they didn't build the air separation plant. So they said we could try to run it on air first. Well, it didn't work very well. Not very successful, and it was shut down after that. We had people back there trying to run that when I first came to work for the company. They never did build the oxygen plant. They never thought that we did well enough on air that they could justify building the oxygen plant. This was the Bureau of Mines that was supporting it. And so that plant was shut down. The site is there where it was. It's not really there anymore. So we decided to go back to coal. And I know you're getting me old. I'm getting ahead of myself. Because after we built the oxygen plant refinery to make hydrogen, it too was designed to pump water and steam, water and oxygen through a heater and convert the whole mixture to steam and oil at pressures high enough to go directly into the burner. And This had been perfected. We had this working in a number of plants around the world, but this was still a mean problem. And so one day we decided, one of all, why do we worry about baked rice in the steam and all this oil before we go in the rest? Well, let's just pump water out of the steam. Work. And it worked all right. I mean, I think kind of about the same time or shortly thereafter, the operations down at the refinery called one morning and something had happened down there and the heater had gone off and they found they were operating on oil, water, and not steam. And they were using a much lighter gas oil. They weren't using the heavy fuel oil. Anyway, we got that perfected, and almost all the plants that we built after that did not have the steam oil vaporizer on the front end. And we decided, if we can do that with residual oil, why can't we do it with coal and water? Let's pump a coal and water sort of pacifier. And we did that. And it worked. We had a lot of problems with learning how to handle the slag from the coal, because this is a slagging gasifier. It was running at temperatures where the slag was, all the ash in the coal was fluid. We had to quench it properly. Well, that was pretty good, and we licensed that technology to Ruhr Chemie in Germany. And we spent a lot of time over there. Of course, Ruhr Coal was also a joint member. Originally, already had an oil gasification plant. They put in a fairly large demo plant. It was tons a day, I think, of coal. And we had a lot of operating problems with it, but they were using it to make methane, which was the end product. Mm-hmm. And we also licensed a plant to Tennessee Eastman, which is still running, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I've been to that plant. Mm-hmm.
They kicked us out after exchange agreement, so we don't really know what they're doing too much anymore. Mm-hmm. Apparently it was doing what they wanted to do. They wanted to have a right high mixture, high concentration of CO in their hydrogen, and if you use oil, and then make more CO someplace, get more carbon into it. And so they like this coal.
This is getting that plant started when?
Hmm?
That plant started up when?
In the mid-70s.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Ruby and that plant started up. And the Ruhr coal plant started up a little before that. Then
I want to, pull you back.
All right.
If I can. I mean, you're moving up in the management of the operation.
Right.
Title's changing. When you became supervisor in 61.
Right. I was supervisor of research in 61.
Yeah. Which meant what?
Well, I was, that's exactly that. I was over all the research. But we had a business manager there. A manager that was in charge of personnel problems.
So who were you replacing?
Well, I was made supervisor of research when Mr. Eastman died. He was manager of research, but they replaced him with the fellow that was business manager before there already, who wasn't really involved in research. He was just in running the laboratory, and money comes out right, and hiring people. And he was made a manager of the laboratory, and I was made director of research. We had a manager of research and supervisor of the laboratory.
So in 61, you were effectively managing
I was the top research person.
Yes. Which was replacing? You say
Mr. Eastman, unfortunately, died in 1961. Yeah. 55. I got the best of him. Very terrible loss.
So actually, inside 8 years, you'd gone from going out to get some experience to running this California operation of Texaco.
Now, in the meantime, I was shipped down to Port Arthur for an assignment down there, and I decided I wanted to go back to Texaco. I mean, I wanted to go back to Caltech, right? Been working Port Arthur. That is, we were just used to too many things in the civilized world, and we didn't have enough.
That was Texas. You were reacting.
Anyway, fine.
Yes. Yeah. When was that?
That was in 57. I shipped down.
How
I
long?
Spent 6 months.
Did the family?
No, they came. I was there about 6 weeks and found a place for me and came back and, you know, drove down. But they didn't like it. We had, our youngest was just baby girl. I mean, if I had a choice, if my choice was to stay at Port Arthur or go back to Caltech would have won.
Why did you go down there? Was that, I mean,
they wanted me to get some experience. They wanted me. I you know, Eastman told me, he said, you're on a fast track, but you're going to have to spend time with Port Arthur.
Yeah, okay, you got to punch the ticket.
All right. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think I needed to do that.
But you went.
Well, I went, yeah, I went for 6 months. And
but how did you get back? What did you say? What did you? How did you unpunch the ticket?
Well, I got Mr. Eastman to say he needed me back in Montebello. But I did that.
Was he?
I mean, I kind of killed my chances of moving on up in the research department.
But moving up would have meant going to New York or something, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, weekend in New York or South or whatever. I could have probably gone out through the Texaco Development Corporation, but that wasn't what I wanted to do.
What's the essential difference? Never mind the Texas piece, but what was the essential difference in what you wanted to do as opposed to what a career track would have been?
Well, I was enjoying immensely what I was doing. I mean, we had all these opportunities out of Mondello, and, you know, I was seeing the world and having all kinds of excitement, and I was getting talks and papers and 2 million patents, and I was quite happy with myself. And I was paid quite reasonably, I guess, at the time, I thought. But I just didn't think that was the life we wanted for our family. And we were down at desegregation was a big issue. And, you know, air conditioning was a rarity. We had air conditioning in the office buildings at work, but all we had in where we lived was an attic fan. And that's, I don't know.
But your boys like a little...
We're talking about Port Arthur. Like.
You've heard me puttering around.
We're in Port Arthur now.
Huh?
We're in Port Arthur now.
Oh.
Would you have some comments?
Was that a good place?
Well, wouldn't you like a little... I just sort of...
Right, how are we on the tape? Well, you can stop it.
We can just stop it.
I'm sorry.
So, by not being a good corporate man and staying in Port Arthur, you were making a set of choices. Why did you do that, and what are your reflections on how it all turned out?
I'm afraid Katie and I talked this over, and we just decided that adding them all the positives and all the negatives, that staying out in Southern California would be fine, because I knew I could probably go back to Caltech if I wanted to. At least I thought I could. Then, unfortunately, it was, I suspect, about a year or 2 years later, DuBridge offered me an assistant professorship at Caltech, and I had to remake the decision what I wanted to do.
So what do you see as the, there's almost three different careers there, if you stayed in Port Arthur or gone back to Caltech, and what is it that you would have had or missed compared with what you did?
Well, you don't know what you missed, but you don't know where you would have gone. But I don't think I would have really enjoyed the type of thing that the general manager of research at Tech Schools has to do.
Namely,
well, I don't know, worry about people and dollars and interior pleasing the president of the company. And it just seemed like it's a challenge, but I just didn't think I wanted to do that. I'd rather. And I, people at Texaco I talked to about it, of course, didn't agree with me. They tried to get me to stay in Port Arthur. And I said, no, I just don't want it. the people were great. I mean, we had just the best of friends, and we still are friends. When I left my position there at the laboratory and moved downtown and got rid of the managerial problems of the research department, later on, unless you can eat. They sent one of the people from Port Arthur out to take my spot. And he's retired, in fact, he retired before I did. And he still lives out here. He can never go back to Port Arthur. His family is still back there, even his kids and everything else. But I mean, you're right. It was a decision. It was difficult for me, not knowing what the consequences would be. And as it turned out, I've been very pleased with it.
What about not going back to Caltech? Why did you?
Well, as I say, then it was about 1958, maybe 59, I got the offer to come back to Caltech, and I kind of expected to get there, but I was happy to get it. And I still have the letter, but this is about the time that, you know, things were really beginning to blossom on what I was doing. It looks like there's going to be real loss of satisfaction ahead. And I turned it down. And I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't turned it down, but I did.
I mean, that offer in part was also an indication that that what you were doing was attracting attention.
Oh, well, it was very much attracting attention, and I was recognized by all kinds of people in the company. I had to go back to New York and know people all over the place, and always want to talk about what's going on out there. My goal, and it was just a little, I'm proud of what you're doing.
You have to help me. Was it from the company point of view, and it was the positive commercial implication?
Well, yeah, I didn't feel that if I was involved in research at either of these other laboratories, that the freedom and the satisfaction you could get out of what you did to be anywhere near equal to what it was at my job. Mm-hmm. And, opportunities that very few people, I think, ever have a chance to have a chance to be involved in. Now, during the early 60s and mid 60s, I hired another PhD from Caltech, and it was one of my earlier students when I was teaching. He was about 7 or 8 years younger than I am. And Neil Richter. And he, like I did, he was an assistant professor there at Caltech for, 10 years, I guess. I mean, he was on the faculty there for about 10 years after he graduated. Got his PhD, maybe not quite that long. I'm not sure when he got his PhD, but it was. But he was getting kind of tired of, well, he didn't know whether he was moving as fast as he wanted to move at Caltech. And I taught them into coming to Montebello. And I tried to get him to, he'll say, well, you people used to ask me who I was bringing up to take over my position. Oh, I got this guy named Montreal. Well, they didn't offer him the job, but he's still there. And he is a fellow, Texaco fellow today. Mm. And he's 71. He's still working. He's still paying a full salary. And goes around and advises people on their research and evaluates what they're doing. And it's an opportunity that it's even better than what I ended up doing.
taking that manager position, which you held for a dozen years.
Mm-hmm.
What's the positive and negative of being in that role?
Well,
Montebello.
It did take time, and I was really spending an awful lot of time there. And my production of patentable ideas began running downhill. And I wanted to know why. I said, well, I just don't have enough time to think about those anymore. I don't know. We had a board of directors meeting in Los Angeles. And one of the things they wanted to do was visit the laboratory. And we were expected to have everything painted up brand new and nothing scattered around. Everything just shifted. And I was a little poke at getting it done. And they sent somebody out there helping get it done. And I don't know, and that's the kind of thing I didn't like to do. I didn't want to show a false picture to anybody. I mean, you know, we don't work in a spick and span laboratory. We have everything fully painted every day. You know, and I wanted them to see the laboratory the way it was. But no, that was not good. I knew him very well, and I knew he wouldn't chastise me at least a bit for not having all spick and span, but the top brass down in Los Angeles, this was their show, and they wanted this to look like it was a mint condition. It was that way for about a week. Anyway, I'm very glad I didn't get into that. That's a false thing. And they know that's what you do when they come around and see it. The board of directors know that this is not the way you operate. It's not the way my bosses in L.A. talk. John McKenna was chairman there. He's the one that got us in trouble over the Getty merger. He was my boss when I went to Port Arthur. Mm-hmm. For those first couple of months. Anyway, I don't regret that I made that decision. I have no way of knowing what would happen if I hadn't made that decision, but I don't think I could be happier.
Well, in 81, when you ceased to be
that's
the
right.
manager, was that also to
that was
get
to
out
free me up, because by that I was expected to do a lot of contact with potential licensees and go out and make talks to pick meetings, but really I couldn't do everything. And I was kind of the spokesman for the technology for the company.
Had Montebello was still small, was it?
Well, by this time it was, but we missed some of the in-between stuff.
Just go, yeah, stay with the, yeah. the, don't go into the technology, just go into the administration,
right.
if you
well,
will, the structure.
When,
a minute.
When, sometime in the late, in the early 70s, the decision was made up on high that we don't need Montebello Research anymore. We're going to close it down. And I left high and dry, but I had a lot of acquaintances up at the Electric Power Research Institute. I don't know if you've ever been there or not. But they have a coal gasification division who is very active at this time. And I kind of sounded them out. And they really wanted to buy Montebello. They won the whole thing. Because they thought the technology was a real winner. And they were backing us 100%. So they agreed. Well, we had earlier, I had been contacting them, and I went to their meetings. And they were quite heavily involved in solvent refining coal with they had a demo plant up near Olympia up in Washington, where an army base. They put a lot of money into that operation. But they couldn't figure out how to get the hydrogen to run a commercial plant. And they had this residual solvent refined coal, which was a pumpable liquid at 11 degrees or so. And they really didn't know what to do with this. And I suggested to them that we could make hydrogen out of it, because they thought it was on my mind. But we were able, and we never were able to do it today with EPA regulations, but we synthesized what this would be. They sent us some of the liquid, and we put some, I forget what they were doing. They were heating it. I don't know what they were doing. They had some way of quenching this stuff in the water, but it was still full of polyaromatic compounds that were dynamite. They sent us a couple of barrels of this stuff, and we mixed it with some coal, made a pumpable mixture out of it, and pumped it in the gasifier, and it really worked very well. And after we thought, you know, we've saved the SRC program, the solar reform coal, because this was the one missing link. And they really were supporting our technology, but we never would build a bigger plant. But they were very interested in our coal gasification technology. And we had someplace along the line, I met a fellow from Pratt & Whitney at a conference in Geneva, and he and I, we came up with what is now a combined cycle coal gasification. And we thought it was fairly novel idea. I mean, I'd never seen it written down where we gasify the coal, clean the sulfur out of it, and burn the CO hydrogen mixture with steam and air generate power, and then use the exhaust of the turbine to generate steam and generate more power. And we worked on paper this thing to run at 50% conversion efficiency. We were both very interested in that, but nobody at that point had ever burned gas in a gas turbine that was as low as 300 BTUs or 275 BTUs per cubic foot with air. So Texaco, TD, that's the development corporation, and Pratt & Whitney's counterpart, agreed to bring and install in Montebello one combustor of a gas turbine. And we actually showed that we could burn, combust thoroughly gas in that combustion chamber with very low NOx coming out. And so that set off the possibility that you could indeed burn syn gas in the gas chamber and do a good job. And because it's has such a low heating value, it doesn't get terribly hot, so you don't make a whole lot of NOx. Well, that was really the supply, or the key thing. And EPRI decided they wanted to really promote this. And they signed a multi-million-dollar contract to do the pilot work at Montebello, and that was enough for the company to decide not to shut the plant down. Instead, they shut down the laboratory in Virginia, and made some of my friends very unhappy. That's what happened. Then Texaco's long-range planning people, some of whom had come from Beacon, had their experience up there, had their heads screwed on pretty good, and talked the board, Texaco management and the board, into supporting a joint program to build a demonstration plant to prove combined cycle coal gasification can and indeed run practically emission free on coal. And we were going to go solicit help from DOE, which we did. DOE agreed, I think, to put up 25% of the cost. We got some other partners. EPRI put in their share. Bechtel was the engineering company, and they put in their share. Standard of Ohio joined. And we got a Japanese consortium to join. And we put together $220 million and built the plant out of cool water. I've heard of it or not. SCE was in the problem. Southern California Edison was in the project because we built the plant on their property. They had a small generating plant out there east of Barstow. And that plant went on stream about 1982, I guess it was. And the whole thing was designed for a 6-year demo program. And the plant was built with the waste heat water on the gasifier exit.